It's Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. Senators reached a deal Thursday to avoid a government shutdown. The deal funds most of the government and also gives Republicans and Democrats time to negotiate on future funding for the Department of Homeland Security. At the center of the negotiations is the federal immigration crackdown across the country and criticisms of Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers who shot and killed a U.S. citizen in Minneapolis last weekend. NHPR's Josh Rogers has been following the New Hampshire delegation's response to the news, and he joins us now. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mark.
Okay, so what are New Hampshire Senators Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen's position on funding for Homeland Security, and ICE specifically?
Well, they've been pretty united, as have Democrats in the Senate, really. They want this standalone discussion of ICE and Homeland Security funding. I mean, they're angry and frustrated over the killings in Minnesota and, you know, have a real gamut of concerns about Homeland Security and ICE contact more broadly. Do recall, though, that Senator Shaheen and Hassan both voted to confirm Kristi Noem to lead Homeland Security. They were just among a handful of Democrats, seven that did so. Shaheen has since said she believes Noem should resign. Hassan, she sits on the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate. She said she wants oversight hearings to hold Noem and other top Homeland Security officials accountable.
How have Representatives Chris Pappas and Maggie Goodlander been responding to the ICE crackdown?
I think more typical of the House. They've been a little bit more, both of them have called essentially for Noem to be impeached. Pappas says, ICE is out of control. We need accountability now. Goodlander says if Noem isn't removed, then impeachment proceedings should begin and that she, say, won't write a, quote, blank check with no accountability for ICE. Obviously the votes for impeachment are not likely to be there.
Right. Yeah. Now, Governor Kelly Ayotte also says she's told DHS and the White House that they should be communicating with officials in the town of Merrimack about a potential plan to build an ICE detention facility there. So, Josh, remind us what we know right now about those plans.
Well, we don't know anything absolute. Some local officials say they know that ICE is eyeing a warehouse on Robert Milligan Parkway for a potential facility, and that's based on purportedly leaked DHS documents, but that's not been confirmed. What is known or really believed to be known mostly springs from a December report in the Washington Post. According to the Post, ICE documents showed plans for a national network of detention facilities holding up to 80,000 people. What would be envisioned for Merrimack would be what was called a, quote, processing site where up to 1,500 detainees might be held. Since then, state and local officials have tried to get more information on ICE's plans to no avail, really. Merrimack's town council wrote the Department of Homeland Security this month in opposition to an ICE facility being located there. They say it would strain infrastructure and potentially cost the town, roughly $500,000 in tax revenue. There have been protests in Merrimack and, lots of questions and concerns that are going to persist.
Yeah. And I know at a press conference this week, the governor was asked about this. She had something to say about it. Does the state have any influence over whether this happens or not?
Seemingly not. And that's what Governor Ayotte told us this week. When the Post first reported the story, she, was eager to dismiss it as rumor and speculation. She's since gotten more attuned to trying to find information. And on Wednesday, she said she and her office had been in touch with officials in the Trump administration and that she made the point that Merrimack needs to be consulted. She also told us that she didn't come up with any answers to any of the questions that she posed.
Did Ayotte have anything else to say about ICE crackdowns across the country and specifically the shootings?
I mean, as far as the shootings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy goes, Ayotte said that those need to be investigated with, quote, transparency. On the Preddy shooting in particular, said she'd like to see that process carried out in the same way a officer-involved shooting might be investigated in New Hampshire, which would be a state investigation. Ayotte said such an investigation would be a precondition of drawing proper conclusions. And, ICE and immigration enforcement is a sensitive topic for her. She ran on that, and she's fully backed having ICE and state police enter into an agreement for the state to potentially assist ICE here. And, while Ayotte's political profile is, largely built on tough on crime law and order, I think for her, law and order really does ideally mean both things. And, what we've seen in Minnesota is clearly nothing any governor, including Kelly Ayotte, would want to see here.
Yeah. Turning to some other state news this week, a federal judge blocked New Hampshire from ending annual mandatory auto inspections. This is getting a lot of attention, obviously, Josh.
Yes.
What did the judge say in the ruling?
Well, Judge Landon McCafferty of the U.S. District Court in Concord basically said that repealing auto inspections here requires EPA approval, which was the point being made by the plaintiff in this case, Gordon Darby, which is a firm that provides the emissions testing gear. They say the Clean Air Act needs to be was implicated there, and that state law did call for inspections to end February 1st. So, you know, time is highly tight. You know, potentially the EPA could quickly rule on this today. That's what some Republicans in the State House say they believe could happen. But, you know, absent that, the law will remain on the books. And this week you saw Republicans scrambling to find ways to blunt the upshot of McCafferty's ruling. They're eyeing stripping or limiting enforcement provisions from the inspection law, you know, making any fine a dollar, making it barring law enforcement from pulling people over for just that reason would be a so-called secondary offense. But, you know, right now, the bottom line is really confusion and a good deal of uncertainty for people who might want to get their cars registered, and also for law enforcement as to how to handle it. Attorney General John Formella says his office is trying to sort guidance on how to handle all this and deal with the action in federal court. I mean, it's worth remembering that this policy was tucked into the state budget late in the process as a way to win support for the plan among conservatives in the House. And, you know, the budget did squeak through by just a vote and on one procedural vote. And so it was an important piece of what happened in the state budget. And it's also true that state and local environmental officials and federal officials warned that we might be in this situation, that the EPA would need to approve. And you know, we're going to see what's happening. I mean, the Auto Dealers Association, meanwhile, advising its members, you know, inspections are on. And I received a solicitation in my email yesterday for a $15
coupon. I did
too.
Yeah.
And so
we'll see what happens next week with this.
Yeah,
this
when Republicans think that maybe they can push through a bill to blunt these things as soon as next week.
All right. NHPR's Josh Rogers, senior political reporter. Thanks so much, Josh.
You're welcome.
You can find more of his reporting, by the way, at NHPR.org. NHPR's document team is out with a new podcast series called Safe to Drink. Hosted by my colleague, Mara Hoplamazian, this podcast investigates what one state regulator has called the largest drinking water contamination in New Hampshire history. Here's an excerpt from the trailer.
One day, Ben Pierce came home to find a bunch of water sitting by his doorstep.
Like a whole massive pallet of water. No explanation, no delivery person. It was just sitting there in the driveway.
Later, he did the math. Someone had delivered roughly 2,700 gallons of water to his house.
There wasn't like a note?
There was nothing, no. I assumed it had to be a mistake.
But it wasn't a mistake. The tap water Ben and his family had been using had something in it, something dangerous.
I knew it was a big deal. Like, you had all the panic, but you didn't realize that, like, as of this date, your whole existence is going to change.
In 2016, a whole town discovered their water had been contaminated by something called a forever chemical. Something that doesn't break down in the environment, that could make people sick.
I want to assure you that we here are as concerned about this as you are.
Can I drink the water? Can my pregnant patients drink the water?
Now they had to figure out what to do about it.
I'm picking up this arrogant, a little mansplaining, and I immediately say something's going on here.
You know, a lot of people ask me, why haven't you left? Why haven't you gone someplace safer?
And Mara joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
As we just heard in the trailer, the town of Merrimack first learned its water had been contaminated by so-called forever chemicals in 2016. Now, that's about a decade ago. So why did you decide to make this podcast now?
Yeah, so I've been covering the aftermath of that announcement since I started as a reporter here in 2021. And that included a major development a couple of years ago. The company that New Hampshire says is responsible for the water contamination, Saint-Gobain, decided to close its Merrimack plant. And I started wondering, you know, Saint-Gobain is gone, but this contamination could take a really, really long time to deal with. I mean, they're called forever chemicals because they don't break down easily in the environment. So I started thinking about this all the time, and I had all these questions like, how are regulators dealing with this? What has this been like for people who've been drinking bottled water for years because their wells are contaminated? What does it mean for people's health? And where did this chemical even come from? And I was thinking about it so much that finally NHPR had to let me make a podcast about it.
Yeah, well, it's a huge story. And of course, it has implications beyond Merrimack. And we'll get to that. But this particular chemical in Merrimack's water is called PFOA. Can you tell us about what you learned about that chemical?
Yeah, I mean, it has a really fascinating history. It goes back to before World War II. It starts with the chemical that we now know as Teflon. So Teflon, or PTFE, was invented in 1938 by a chemist at DuPont, totally by accident. And then the U.S. military got interested in it when they were trying to make the first atomic bombs. And this stuff blew people's minds. You know, it was extremely slippery, resistant to the elements, really durable. The guy who invented it accidentally said he couldn't find anything in his lab that would dissolve it. And as DuPont was starting to find consumer applications for this stuff, another company, 3M, invented a related chemical called PFOA that turned out to be really useful for manufacturing Teflon. So as Teflon started being used in all kinds of products, you know, raincoats, pots and pans, so did PFOA.
Now, what was Saint-Gobain using PFOA for at the Merrimack plant?
So their specialty was making performance fabrics coated with a special mixture that included PFOA. And they bought the chemicals that they used from companies like DuPont and 3M. Saint-Gobain workers turned those special fabrics into things like domes that you see over sports stadiums or covers, like radome covers and hazmat suits. But we now know that PFOA was coming out of the plant's stacks while they were making those fabrics and settling into the groundwater in surrounding communities. And as we discuss in the podcast, DuPont and 3M knew for decades that these chemicals could be harmful to humans, but they kept that information secret, including from regulators. But then there was this landmark lawsuit out of West Virginia that forced it all out into the open around 2001.
Okay, that was years before the PFOA contamination was even known here in Merrimack. Why did it take so long to figure this out?
So there are several reasons, but a really important one is the federal government had no enforceable regulations for how much PFOA could be in drinking water until 2024. And one New Hampshire regulator I talked to said, you know, PFOA just wasn't on their radar. Reporting this story, I kept thinking it was like there were all these bubbles. PFOA contamination would pop up in one place and then another and then another. But each time it was like nobody had ever heard of this stuff before. They weren't sure what to do. It was an emerging contaminant. So Safe to Drink is about people who popped those bubbles, helped connect all the dots. And a lot of the people I talked to are not professional scientists or regulators. They're residents who had the feeling that something was wrong and they decided to do something about it.
Mara Hoplamazian is NHPR's climate change reporter and the host of the new podcast series from the Document team called Safe to Drink. All four episodes are out now on your favorite podcast app. And you can learn more about it at nhpr.org/safetodrink. Mara, thanks so much for the time and the thorough reporting.
Thank you so much, Rick.
And you can also find on our website Mara's new reporting from a meeting this week about Londonderry's plans to connect residents there with clean water because their private wells have also been contaminated. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.